Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go.
Everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Cal Fritzy. As usual, we always have something to discuss, and today we're going to be discussing something rather interesting. We're going to be taking on the hijab and the niqab and explaining to you why it is not an issue of submission, but it is actually an issue of dominance. And before I delve any further, though, I am bringing on the co-host, and that is Tim Burton. Hello, Mr. Tim Burton. How are you today?
Well, good evening, Kel. I'm very well, and how the devil are you?
Well, I'm not mendaciously fine.
Well,
all right, I'll let it go.
I suppose that's a good thing. Yes. Well, I hope you're infidelity fine, because I'm unbelievably well as well. So that's all good news. But yes, I don't suppose there's anybody out there who doesn't know the meaning of the word mendacious by now, except, of course, possibly Mr. Fiaz McGull, who, after all the posturing, and whining, it transpired in court last week, ladies and gentlemen, that he didn't even know what the meaning of the word was at all. But there you go. You learn something new every day, and we won our case, which is the important thing, and
a big
success, not only for freedom of speech, but for the concept of getting the concept of taqiyya in Islamic doctrine out into the public space through the courts, through the British court system. So that's a really big plus, because taqiyya goes right to the heart of what it means to the relationship between non-Muslims and Muslims. If you're allowed to lie at every opportunity, which Muslims are, when it comes to promoting Islam to non-Muslims or preventing the denigration of Islam in the eyes of non-Muslims, then it puts us as non-Muslims at a grave disadvantage, because we are simply unused to dealing with people who have raised the unpleasant habit of lying and deceit to an art form. But once everybody of goodwill, by which I mean everybody non-Muslim, realizes that this is the case, hopefully we'll be able to say to the Muslims, we're wise to what you're doing, now knock it off. Because it's not reasonable to expect that situation to continue, where Muslims pull the wool over our eyes through lies and deceit, and expect that situation to go on long enough for them to take over our countries, basically. I mean, I suppose they might think, well, it's worked well enough in the past, but this is the age of information, and knowledge is power, and if that information is widely known, then people just will not stand for it. And that's why I think this judgment was so important. But I won't go into it in too much detail, unless I've got a caller later on who wants me to.
Hey, yeah, if you guys want to call in later, and if you have any questions for Tim, by all means, please call in a little later. We always take calls. We like taking calls here, and you can call in at 347-237-4318. And if you have any questions about the subject matter of the show as well. And you're probably hearing a little bit of plinking going on behind me. I have my Skype on, which I usually don't when I'm taping a show, but I'm arranging an interview for Mike Holt of Restore Australia with a gentleman from Tunisia, and he is sending me all of his info and stuff like that. So if you hear the little plinking in the background, that's what's going on there, folks. But, yeah, if you want to speak with Tim, or, hey, come on, speak with me, and ask any questions. If you have any queries about what happened this week, by all means, please do so at that phone number. And, of course, you can skippity Skype and the Skype button is right there at the top of the page. But, oh, Tim, you know what? Yeah, I know. You're probably getting so overwhelmed because you're not only discussing this on your own programs, which include RSB, Radio Jihad Network, and Liberty GB, and, of course, you're a panelist at EDL Radio. But you're getting sought out by so many people that want you to discuss it. You must be exhausted.
Well, not really, Kel, to be honest with you. I mean, obviously, it's a big relief that the trial is over and I was acquitted. But the trial itself, because it was of such importance, really, with what the judge said in his summing up, I'm happy to talk about it all day long. I mean, you know me. If somebody locks me in a room with a donkey, I'll talk the hind legs off it. So there's plenty of donkeys wandering around, two-legged donkeys wandering around out there because I've been talking so much. But I don't really have a problem with going over it again for the benefit of our listeners. I know we have, since last Tuesday, we've discussed it quite extensively, but there may well be one or two people who are listening on this show for the first time and haven't realized that the trial went the way it did. And certainly for those people, if they'd like me to elaborate a little bit more, I'm happy to do it. But of course, one of the great things about the trial and the run-up to the trial was that the phrase mendacious grievance mongering Takiya artist went round the world several times, which I'm sure pleased Fiaz Maghal no end. He's probably busy stomping up and down his office and terrorizing the poor people that are working for him now, because he's lost the case and he's known to everybody around the world as the mendacious grievance mongering Takiya artist in chief. And that reminds me, Kel, we've got some mugs, haven't we, to give away?
Yes, we do. And today's trivia question, ladies and gentlemen, is what exactly does mendacious mean? And we need that in a sentence. Now, you do not have to call into the program, okay? Tim and I, we were talking about this, and we decided that the first person that can give us the definition or the answer to our trivia question, just Skype me. I am RFB WOW co-host. I have the little rose there. Just inbox me right there if you don't want to call in, because I know a lot of people don't like calling into the shows here, Tim. So you know what? We are allowing you to partake in winning your very own limited edition mendacious grievance mongering Takiya artist coffee mug. Tell us exactly what does mendacious mean. Inbox me or call in. You can call in if you're not shy, please do call in. And the call-in number, of course, is 347-237-4318. But what exactly does mendacious mean? What is the definition of mendacious? And like I say, and Tim and myself say, if you don't want to call in, just inbox me. Just go to the site there and click on me, send me a private message, and I will take your details. If you're correct and you win, I will get your details, and your mug will be in the mail on its way. I also want to express that this is a very important contest, because not only do we bring awareness to what happened with our Cat Strangler 101, but we also are encouraging people to donate to the Cat Strangler 101 Defense Fund. You don't have to do that. Now, keep in mind, if you want to answer the trivia question, you don't have to donate. You don't have to do that. Just answer the trivia question. It's just all fun here. We're having fun. So what is the meaning? What exactly is the meaning of mendacious? Get me on my inbox or phone into the program and win yourself a coffee mug. It'll be in the mail for you this week. There you go, Kip.
Yes, yes, indeed. And these coffee mugs, of course, are going to be very highly sought after in the future. Whereas nowadays, of course, people measure their wealth by the number of Renoirs and Van Goghs that they have hanging on the walls of their palaces and their castles. In the future, things like that will be old hat, and people will say, yeah, I know you've got a painting on your wall, but have you got one of the mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist coffee mugs from 2014? And that will be the true measure of wealth in the future, ladies and gentlemen. So get onto Kel right now and see if you can't win yourself one, because it's an investment for the future. I can guarantee that.
I think so.
Indeed. I'm just going to put the link to my legal defense fund into the chat room, which is freedomlovinginfidel.blogspot.co.uk. Kel briefly mentioned it, and I'll just say that every penny helps if you can spare a few pennies. What am I talking about? Sell your house, sell your car. Sell your dog.
Sell your first and second. No, don't sell the first wife. Sell the second, third, and fourth wife.
Yeah.
And for our archive listeners, I have the link in the show highlights, so you can, go up there and click on that, and that'll get you to the freedomlovinginfidel.blogspot.com. And there you go. Oh, and I want to congratulate our previous winners. Our previous winners include Bigfoot, Eric of Kafristan. Who else? Agador. Yes.
Agador, yeah.
Your mug is in the mail. I was late getting it to the mail. It's in the post, though, so you'll get it probably early, either next week or at the very, well, later this week or at the very most early next week. So it's in the mail, Agador. So I want to congratulate the winners for winning that beautiful, mendacious coffee mug. Believe me, you will enjoy your coffee. You will savor your coffee that much more. And Tim, hang on.
You all right, Kel? You haven't dropped something cold down the back of your T-shirt, have you?
No. Oh my goodness. Okay. Let me see here. Tim, hang on.
Uh-huh.
I'm so excited.
Okay. What's happening?
We have a winner.
Hey.
The trivia question, and Eric, you are now the proud owner of your limited edition Kel's Mama coffee mug. See, Tim, I get so excited about these things, you know. Eric, congratulations, and I will be in touch with you to get your mailing details, and your coffee mug will be in the mail this week just for you, Eric. Thank you very much. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, Eric Kyle from the chat room, he just won himself a limited edition coffee mug, the mendacious grievance. Tim?
The mendacious
grievance-mongering
Takiya artist coffee mug. Well done, Eric. Well done, Eric. And for those of you who were pipped at the post by Eric today, do not despair. You know, don't, whatever you do, go out and throw yourself off a tall building, because you will have an opportunity in the weeks to come to win one of these coffee mugs. We do have some left, and we will be giving them away in answer to some trivia questions over the next few weeks. So if you didn't win this week, do not despair. Do not fret. I'm sure there is one here with your name on it. So just keep listening to the Red Fox radio WOW, and you will be in line, I am sure, in due course for one of these wonderful mugs. So, there we go.
That is exactly right. And there we go. See, wasn't that easy, people? See, you just answer a little trivia question and look at what you get. And if you want to see what that mug looks like, just scroll up to the top. I've got the slide in there. Oh, and by the way, if you want to see what Tim and myself look like, you can see us there too. Tim's the good looking one with the look of victory on his face.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know something, Kel? I haven't told you this, but when my brother saw my picture, he actually put a message on the picture and to say that is Tim's smug face. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I was terribly insulted. Well, I wasn't as insulted as I was when his next message was, it's not so very different from his gloating face. Many people can't tell the difference. So I suppose, well, that's brothers for you. You can't pick your own, you can't pick your family, can you, Kel? You can pick your friends, but you can't pick your family.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And believe me, I wish that we could. Because there are some family members that would probably say the same thing about me. Because, I always kind of walk around with a little smug look on my face, but that's because I always reign victorious. And I'm sorry, that's just the way it is.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up then, because there's a lot of people that write to me and say, why does Kel always walk around with a smug look on her face? And I'm going, well, I don't know. Don't ask me. We might not want to know the answer to that, but it's probably because, of course, she's got a new kitchen now, and she's been showing off this new kitchen on Facebook. And ladies and gentlemen, if you want one of these kitchens, you need to write to Kel and get her to give you the name and contact number of the people who installed it, because I tell you what, that is a kitchen to die for. The concealed lighting, the vomit green cupboards, the splashback tiling.
They're not vomit.
Sorry.
They're forest green.
Forest green, yes. Sorry about that.
You're terrible.
But the concealed lighting is absolutely wonderful, that little blue light bulb there, and the splashback tiling. I can safely say I've never seen splashback tiling quite like that. And I mean
it's Italian Baroque.
Oh yeah, that's right. It looks Baroque. That's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought. I looked at that tiling and I said, that looks Baroque to me. If it ain't Baroque, don't fix it. That's what I always say. But
you are just too darned funny. Oh my goodness. And you want a raise on RSB Radio WoW?
Oh, yes, please.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, yes, ladies and gentlemen, behind me is my beautiful retro kitchen. And believe me, it does need to be retrofitted. I'm waiting for the track lighting to be installed. But I had to have this temporary thing installed so I could do the dishes because, I'm in Canada. It gets dark here rather early before the Eastern Daylight kicks in. And so, 5 o'clock, it's nothing to be in the dark by 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon here in the wintertime, of course. And so I needed something there so I could, do dishes. And, okay, why are we talking about this?
No, you carry on, Kel. I'm quite happy to listen to this for the entire show. It's just absolutely fascinating stuff. I just thought it was worth a comment. Kel's kitchen, ladies and gentlemen. It's what's the word that comes to mind? Retro, I suppose, is the word that comes to mind. But if you want a kitchen like that, ladies and gentlemen, just get Kel to give you the gentleman's business card. He's very reasonable, and he's obviously got a long queue of clients who want kitchens looking exactly like Kel's. But if you take his business card, he'll add you to that queue, and probably in about 3 or 4 years' time, he'll get round to you and he'll do you a kitchen just like Kel's. So, don't
despair. I swear. But Bigfoot and Agador said that he's in Vermont, and 5 o'clock in the afternoon in winter it's dark. And Bigfoot said, on the other hand, when June rolls around, it would be daylight at 9 p.m. up at my place. And Bigfoot, that's true. But in the wintertime, we're laying this track lighting, and it's just being such a real pain. And so I finally, in frustration, I rigged up this light so that I could at least do my dishes. It was just absolutely unbelievable in that kitchen. It was so dark with the overhead light. It didn't do anything. So, and ladies and gentlemen, welcome to RSB Radio Well, kitchen renovation episode number 432. There you go, Tim.
Yes, excellent. Yeah, I can tell by the comments in the chat room that they're all hanging on your every word, Kel, and that's absolutely as it should be. But I suppose we'd probably better move along to the topic that we have for today, which is...
Absolutely. And that is, ladies and gentlemen, we are moving into the subject matter, and that is the hijab and the niqab means domination. Now, as many of you are aware, there are a lot of people out there that say that the hijab and the niqab is a form of submission. And I would be inclined to agree. But what the hijab and the niqab really represents in the West, in particular, where people come here to be free. People immigrate to these Western countries to be free, in which they can shed their shackles, okay? In Afghanistan, women have no choice. They're covered up. They're shackles. But when you come to the West, you can shed those shackles, and you do not have to don the hijab, nor the niqab, nor any sort of Middle Eastern dress that would identify you as a submission under the rule of Islam. It's a guise, is what it is. And we are here today to explain to you exactly why, in the West in particular, why the hijab and the niqab and any other Western garb, or Middle Eastern garb, my apologies, is a form of domination. What they're essentially telling us, Tim, is that it's saying that we're here, we're different, and we're better than you, and that's the impression I get. I have a clip that I'm going to play in a few moments, but Tim, what do you think about that?
Well, it is quite true. I mean, we've got used, I suppose, now in most Western countries to seeing women walking around in the hijab and the niqab. And while it might have seemed a little strange to start with, the political correctness and multiculturalism that we've all been exposed to for the last 40 years has meant that we've tended not to be openly critical about it, because we take the view that if people wish to dress in a certain way, then fine, we should. This is a free country, on the one hand, and we should allow people to wear what they want in public. But the problem with something, especially the niqab, let's take the niqab first, which covers the face, and with something like that, that actually has a completely different effect. If you're going to say to people, all right, you can wear what you want in public, that's one thing. But if you obscure your face, you're going right to the heart of what it means to live in a free country. We mm-hmm. are generally a very open and tolerant people. And the reason we're open and tolerant is that when we encounter our fellow man, we expect them to be open and tolerant back, by and large. There's always, of course, odd individuals who don't conform to that. But by and large, if we go out and meet our friends and neighbours in the street, we tell a great deal about them from their facial expressions and their body language, of course. And if your face is obscured, you lose a great deal, if not virtually all, of the signals that you would use in the normal interaction social interaction back and forth that you would expect to get. And that's very intimidating. You know, even if that person means you no harm and only wants to go about their business, you really cannot have a social interaction with them on the same level that you could with any of your other friends and neighbours, because they're excluding themselves from you. They're retreating into their own private little world. Okay, you might say, on one level, if they want to do that, they're entitled to it. And if it was just the odd individual, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, well, you know, you could just say, all right, if they want to be like that, fine. But when they make up a significant percentage of the population, people like us start to, the level of intimidation just through not being able to see what the people around you are thinking and feeling through their facial expressions, it leads to a very intimidatory atmosphere. And it goes far beyond the freedom to wear what one wants to fundamentally altering the relationship between them and us. And that's why it's so important to discuss this, that if we allow this to happen, we're not just being open and tolerant ourselves, we're actually allowing them to completely change the relationship between them and us through them hiding their faces and the ability to express their body language.
Well, what I think is it's a form of intimidation with me, in that when I interact with a person wearing the niqab, of course, the niqab, the full face covering, I can't. I find that intimidating. I get bristled, and my body language changes, because I don't know with whom I'm speaking. I do not know how to read them. I do not know, they can speak in a voice, be agreeable, but, and I can see blinking of eyes, but I cannot see the full facial expressions as to whether or not that we're actually having a true interaction, a true communication. The hijab is bad enough. I think that what that represents to me is that they're wearing the hijab because they can, and it's a political movement. Wearing this garb is nothing more than a political movement, and it does say to me that I'm here and I'm different, and I'm going to, shove my beliefs in your face in my dress, and I don't like that. There's a difference between, say, wearing a crucifix around your neck or wearing the yarmulke on your head or anything like that. But when you wear a full covering over your head and you're speaking with me, I'm sorry, I'm not going to take you even at face value. I'm going to take you as a political entity, and that you're trying to usurp my political entity. That's the way I see it, Tim.
Well, I think that's a sensible way to look at it, because they are making a statement when they choose to dress in that fashion. They may rationalise it internally and say, "Well, it's my right to wear whatever I want." And as an individual, I wouldn't argue with that, but they fail to take into account the effect that the cumulative effect of a lot of people dressed like that occupying our public space has on the rest of us. You know, we're, as you say, you don't know who is behind that niqab, what their intentions are. You cannot tell even if they're male or female in some instances, and you certainly don't know what their intentions are, because their faces are hidden. And that's important, because if you can't see what somebody's intentions are, you can't assume that they're necessarily well-meaning towards you. And if you've got a lot of people wandering around like that, it's very unsettling. And so it's one thing to say, yeah, this is my right as an individual to wear this particular garment if I want in public. But the cumulative effect is really unsettling to the extent that it alters the relationship between us and them substantially. And if the individuals want to say, okay, I want that right to do that as an individual, then somebody at the level of our political elite really has to make a decision about whether that's a good thing for the country as a whole and for the indigenous population in particular. I submit that it is not a good thing because it has this intimidatory, unsettling characteristic when you have more than the occasional one. Like I say, if it was only 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, it wouldn't really mm-hmm. matter, because you'd see one of these people coming round the corner and you say, oh yeah, that's old Fatima, you know, and you either greet her or not, depending on what you thought of Fatima, you know. But when there's dozens of them wandering around, you don't know who is who. And it's just not the way in which we have normally conducted our social interactions with people in the West for hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's just alien to us. So if our political elites say we have to put up with this, then I think we have every right to feel resentful, because it goes right to the heart of what it means to interact with your fellow man. And if we can't interact with people in the way that we've always been used to, I think we have a right to feel resentful about it and to say we don't like it, and not to be accused of racism, bigotry, Islamophobia, hate mongering or so on for expressing our opinions. And that is something that's happening more and more often, of course. I think we discussed this on a show in the not too distant past. This was something mm-hmm. in my own country, in the United Kingdom, where at a college in Birmingham, the authorities decided they were going to ban the niqab on campus for health and safety reasons. I mean, that seems to be a reasonable thing to do. If you want to increase health and safety in the public space, it helps mm-hmm. to know who you're dealing with, especially if somebody does something that you later want to come back to them for. I don't know any sort of infringement of the rules that might, for example, be caught on CCTV. Just as a simple example, if you can identify people via CCTV, that's great. If they're walking around in a niqab, of course, you cannot identify them. You don't know if they're male or female or who they are or whatever. And if they've committed a transgression or done something that you want to talk to them about, you've got no chance because you don't know who they are. So health and safety seemed like a reasonable basis for this. But some of the students at this college decided that this was Islamophobia, and they got up a petition, and they got a lot of people to sign it, and presented it to the authorities at the college, who immediately or almost immediately caved in, backed down, and said, okay, you can wear a niqab on college premises. And I think that was a tremendously retrograde step, and a lot of people who spoke about this in the media in the weeks following also felt the same thing. It was a retrograde step, but that is what you get when a lot of Muslims or Muslim sympathizers get together and produce a petition and say, we want it done our way or else, because that's the implied threat, the or else. And we know, ladies and gentlemen, when Muslims say or else, it's often not an empty threat. They cause trouble. Mm-hmm. And by causing trouble, I don't just mean that they sit down and write a letter to the Daily Telegraph, because they don't. In many cases, it leads to violence in public, rioting, the destruction of property, and in some instances, it leads to people being killed. And so the pressure is always on for the authorities to give way to Muslim threats and intimidation. And, all right, if it only ever happened once, you could maybe say, all right, well, let's learn from this and let's not put up with it ever again. But what's happening is people in authority are giving in all the time. Whenever there are Muslim demands, the pressure is on for the authorities to give in, and they seem to be so spineless, so lacking in principle, that 9 times out of 10 they do give in to Muslim demands. And when that happens,
yeah,
we lose a little bit more of our freedom.
Oh, exactly. And what happened in Canada in particular is that the Parti Québécois, when they tried to introduce the family values clause, and that was Pauline Moreau's, they went to the election booths last week, and the Parti Québécois, they lost their seat. And they were trying to introduce this family values clause in which no overt religious dress would be welcome in any public institution. They were trying to butter it up, though, by saying that she lost the election because she was also talking about Quebec separation. Quebec has always been whining and whinging and whining about wanting to leave Canada and become their own sovereignty. And when she started speaking about that, she dropped in the polls. But the family values clause certainly hurt her as well, and that there were so many protests. And there were not only the Muslims and other faith-based groups, so-called faith, you know, Muslims is not a faith-based group, but there were many faith-based groups that were complaining about her stance that we will not accept the yarmulke, we will not accept the niqab or the hijab, we will not accept the overt cross around the neck, and we will certainly not accept the Sikh headdressing. And they really went after her very, very badly. And Pauline Moreau lost her seat. The Parti Québécois is done. It's over. It's gone. But a lot of people were trying to say, well, you know what, it's just because she was making noises about Quebec separating from Canada again, and the people in Quebec are sick of that. But that is not the case. I think that there's a lot more to it. And you're right, Tim, is that these universities, being the hotbeds that they are, is that they can create a lot of influence. And one thing we're going to discuss a little later on is A.N. Hershey Alley being denied an honorary degree in an American university because the Muslim Association in that university started their petition and said that, no, she's a poor example, and we do not want her to have an honorary degree because what she says is it's hurtful, it's degrading to Muslims, and the Muslims won. And so the university backed down. And let me see, what's the name? Brandeis University. I'm not too sure how to pronounce it. It's, if I was in the United States, I would pronounce it Brandeis University. But in Canada, it would probably be pronounced Brandeis University. So I'm not too sure. So it's just a damned shame. But you know what? Want to keep on this topic, Tim, and discuss about how the hijab and the niqab are actually arsenals in the West?
Yeah, sure. We can give plenty more examples. I'm sure. As you were talking, I was thinking about another example here in the UK where a girl at a school wanted to wear the jilbab, which is not quite the same as wearing a niqab, but it's still an all-encompassing garment, and it took several appeals, I believe, and this was maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. I'll have to find the link if I can. But it took several appeals before she was finally told that no, she wasn't allowed to wear that garment in the school because of the disruption it would cause. And she, of course, claimed it was nothing but Islamophobia, and gave everybody a terrible time before somebody who the hell was it now? I don't know if it was, it might even have been Boris Johnson, you know. I'm going to have to find the article, but the point was that the appeals process went through court after court after court, must have racked up close to £1 million in taxpayers' money before the decision came down that no, she was not allowed to wear the jilbab in school. There was a school uniform. If somebody wished to wear modest clothing, there was an alternative in modest clothing that she could wear, and the jilbab was deemed to be not acceptable. But it took a great deal of public money to actually get that that decision there. And it's another example, of course, of the lawfare that Muslim pressure groups use if they can find a way to attack our democratic system through forcing us to spend a lot of time and money fighting these spurious claims than they will do. And it's purely because the people in authority who ought to have the backbone to stand up to Islamic intimidation, they are not doing their job. They're caving in when they shouldn't be. What should happen is that that Muslims should be treated in exactly the same way as any other group, and for them not to be given the special consideration that they're getting now. But because everybody is so scared of losing their job or getting some sort of opprobrium because of taking a stance against Muslims, nobody does it. Everybody gives in whenever they can, and it leads to a very detrimental effect on our society.
And that it does, and that is the lawfare raising its ugly head again. And what we're going to do, though, ladies and gentlemen, and Tim and I, we're actually giving you homework. So if you have your pen and pad in front of you on your desk or on your lap or, wherever you are, we're giving you homework. We're going to play a clip by Dr. Bill Warner. It's 7 minutes long, but this is the argument about the hijab and the niqab being nothing more than a political statement in the West. And Tim and myself, we're going to see you back here in 7 minutes. Right, Tim?
Just before we do that, I'd just like to say that talk tonight has been very much appreciated. Dodgy Dave has put in the chat room, "It's a good job I've tuned in tonight. The topic has reminded me that I need to buy some black bin liners tomorrow." So glad to have been of service, Mr. Dave. And I'll let you play that.
And I also have to thank Agador because he helped me with the pronunciation of a Brandeis University. That's how you pronounce it, Brandeis University. So thanks, Agador, to you too. And Dodgy Dave, no problem. Here we go, Tim. Well, everybody, like Tim says, do some homework. We're giving you homework. We'll see you back here in 7 minutes.
I'd like to talk to you today about fashion, Islamic fashion that has political consequences. I was at the farmer's market a couple of weeks ago, and I saw a little Mennonite girl, and she had a lacy kind of head covering on, and I thought, that looks kind of charming. And then a few minutes later, I saw a black woman who had a kerchief on her head, African style, that was bright orange and bright red and looked very colorful. And then as I was leaving the farmer's market, I see a woman in a hijab, and that put my teeth on edge. As I was driving home, it was a day for head coverings because lo and behold, there was a woman, a Catholic nun, and she had head covering on. 4 head coverings in one day, but only one of them made me feel a little not so good. And why is that? Well, the hijab, I happen to know, is a symbol. And it's a symbol of the fact that the woman wearing it is fully committed to the Sharia. When I was young, we were fighting an ideological war with Russia. There was something called a card-carrying communist. And that meant someone who was fully committed. And the hijab means that you're looking at a person who's fully committed to the Sharia. And that has political consequences. For instance, Islam loves symbols. The attack on 9/11, 2001, was a symbolic date. And whenever you see the black flag of Al-Qaeda, it's a symbol. It is a symbol of the oppression of Islam and jihad and the Sharia. And so the hijab is a symbol as well. It's a symbol that says to me, I'm a kafir, an unbeliever, an infidel. So these things all have political consequences. And one of the things that I see when I look at a hijab is the politics of Islam as it's operated over 1,400 years. There's been jihad against the kafirs for 1,400 years. And so when I see that hijab, I see that history, a history of annihilation, death, and suffering. But when I see the hijab, I also see something else. It says to me, again, I'm a kafir. And this is not a casual word, because indeed the bulk of the Quran is about the kafir. I'd like to read to you some verses that talk about me, the Kafir, and you, if you're a Kafir too. They who dispute the signs of Allah, and they would be Kafirs, without authority having reached them, are greatly hated by Allah and the believers. Another verse. When you encounter the unbelievers on the battlefield, cut off their heads until you have thoroughly defeated them. Yet another verse. They, the Kafirs, plot and scheme against you, Muhammad, and I, Allah, plot and scheme against them. So the Kafirs were annihilated. All praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds. So when I see a hijab, I see the fact that I'm a Kafir. And by the way, Allah hates me because I'm a Kafir, so to me the hijab is a hate symbol, just in the same way that a Klan outfit is symbolic of racial hate to a black man. But let's look in the Quran for a little bit more, because it says some very disturbing things about the relationship between me and this woman. It's all about friendship. You see, there are 13 verses in the Quran which deal with friendship, and they have some very bad implications. Let's listen to them. Believers should not take unbelievers as friends in preference to other believers. Another verse. Believers, do not become friends with anyone except your own people. Again, believers, do not take unbelievers as friends over fellow believers. Would you give Allah a clear reason to punish you? So this is terrible news. This means that the lady in the hijab is not my friend, nor can we become friends. Now, if you know some Muslims, you're going to be going, oh, Bill, I know some Muslims, and they're very friendly. There is a big difference between being friendly and friends. Let me give you an example. If you go down to any used car lot, you will quickly meet some people who are very friendly, but they're not really your friends. Now, I said at the beginning that the hijab was a symbol of the Sharia, and I'm going to read you some things that the Sharia lays out that establish a relationship between me and this woman. By the way, if you ever get a chance to pick up the book, Reliance of the Traveler, do so. It is fascinating. And in the back, if you look in the index, there's a whole section on unbelievers, a column and a half. Now, some of these references to me as a Kafir and unbeliever are religious, in the sense of, I'm going right straight to hell. I don't care about that stuff. What I do care is how the Sharia lays out the relationship between me and a Muslim. Fascinatingly enough, there is a subject called lying, and under that is another subdivision called permissible lying. I did not hear him, Muhammad, permit untruth except for three things: war, settling disagreements, and a man talking with his wife or she with him. When it is possible to achieve such an aim by lying but not telling the truth, it is permissible to lie, if attaining the goal is permissible, and obligatory to lie if the goal is obligatory. Now, believe it or not, there's a subject also on hate. This clarifies the Quranic verses and hadiths about hatred for Allah's sake and love for the sake of Allah, being unyielding towards the Kafirs, hard against them, and detesting them. Now, here is the sadness of this. And by the way, the verses about the friendship between the Muslim and the Kafir are to me some of the saddest things about Islam. But do you understand here that there is a great gulf between me and the lady wearing the hijab? And it's a gulf that I cannot bridge, because Allah is telling her and Muhammad is telling her how to relate to me. And I will never persuade her that Allah is wrong and that I'm right and that we can be friends. So just as the Klan outfit establishes an unbridgeable goal between the wearer of the Klan outfit and the black man, so the hijab also establishes, sadly enough, an unbridgeable gap. Now, there are some who would say to me, Bill, you are such the hater. Why, the hijab is cultural, and in America we honor all cultures, because, you see, all cultures are really equivalent. So you are a hater because you don't like the hijab. No, I'm not a hater. It's simply that I know what the hijab symbolizes, and the people who hand out this politically correct multicultural advice don't know anything about Islam. Or at least, that has been my experience over time. That those who hand out this cheap cultural advice know nothing about Islam, so we have an empty head mouthing empty words. So the next time you see a hijab, remember, it is not a fashion statement. It is a statement about Islam, political Islam, and how we are to be dominated. Thank you.
And And that is exactly what it is. It's a political statement, ladies and gentlemen, and we know that Islam is nothing more than a political entity, and that they are pushing around, and they are letting us know that they're here, and they are going to let us know that they're here in very loud noises, in their dress, in their demeanor, in their attitude. And what Dr. Bill Warner had to say is absolutely phenomenal, and as usual, Dr. Bill Warner is right on the money with that. But before we get into that, Tim, I want to acknowledge that we have people joining us, and we want to thank Agador and Bigfoot, Dodgy Dave, Eric Kyle, Anna of Freedom Show. We have guests in here, and if one of you are Terry, Luchadora, Vito Esposito, who has a show tonight on Radio Jihad Network at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. And what do you think, Tim?
Yeah, it's sorry, I dropped out onto the last sentence. Can you just repeat that again, please, Kel?
I was just wondering what Dr. Bill Warner had to say is that when we do see the hijab and the niqab, it's not required dress. It's not required. It's not been recorded in the Quran that it is, but they wear it all the same. They are oppressed, of course, in Middle Eastern countries. Afghanistan is prominent in my mind in that women are forced to cover up. But when one arrives on our Western shores, there's no need for it anymore. And I would think that people like what the Parti Québécois tried to accomplish is trying to unshackle the women from this dress. And it was the very women who were protesting, and they were saying, this is my religion. No, it's not your religion. What it is, it's your political statement.
Yeah, and I don't think that things will change a great deal if we look to the women themselves to actually push that change through, because I have the impression that the mindset that they have is going to militate against that. If they think that they're doing it for religious reasons, if the kuffar, that's you and me, tells them that it's not for religious reasons at all, I don't think they're likely to take any notice of us. I think the change has either got to come from within Islam, which is unlikely because everything that Islam has done over the past 1400 years has worked out very well for Islam. Why would they change? So it's really up to our political elites to say what is and isn't going to be acceptable in the public space in our Western countries. And I think we are going to have to impose rules that people are going to view, at least in the short term, as discriminatory. Well, discrimination is not necessarily the universal evil that people on the left of the political spectrum would have us believe that it is. I've written about this in the past, and I've likened it to just go back 10,000 years when you've got a Stone Age hunter and he's out and about facing a world which has a lot of dangers, and if he wasn't able to discriminate between something harmless like a little pussycat and round the next corner there's a saber-toothed tiger, and if he couldn't discriminate between the two, it would be a sad lookout for him, I suggest. And so discrimination is not always the evil that people make it out to be. And when you talk about, talking about the survival of a Stone Age individual, but if you fast forward 10,000 years, we're now talking about the survival of our Judeo-Christian civilization. And we are going to have to discriminate between things that are relatively harmless to our civilization and things which have an existential threat to our civilization, such as Islam and all its political ramifications. And the niqab and the hijab are just two of those political ramifications which we're going to need to address for the reasons that Bill Warner said.
Well, I've always had a problem with overt religious dress, and I'm using air quotes here with that. And I think, though, that Islam is very much more forceful in their religious dress, and that there's no reason for them. They are separating themselves when they do this, and it bothers me. It bothers me greatly, because I believe that when you're in Rome, for example, you do as the Romans do. When you come to Canada or the United States or to the UK, that you adapt to the culture of the country, and these people are not adapting. They're differentiating themselves in such a manner to the point of intimidation, and I had brought that up in this conversation on the show. But it bothers me more so because it is being passed down. They come, they have families, and it's passed down, and the ideology of Islam grows. When I don't understand, for example, why women would want to thrust Islam in our faces, because Islam treats women terribly. Islam, the Sharia law, is a terrible, terrible, terrible chapter within the realm of Islam. So why on earth would they want to propagate this within our culture? I don't understand that.
Well, I think I could approach that from one of two ways, actually, Kel. One is, it depends which women you're talking about. Now, if it's the Islamic women themselves, they're going to be under a lot of peer pressure from other people in their community not to rock the boat, to stand with Islam against the kuffar, and pressure like that is very difficult to withstand. It's far easier for a woman in that sort of environment just to keep quiet and not rock the boat, put up with the indignities, no matter how severe they may be, and put up with the oppression and being treated as a second-class citizen, because that's what's expected from your community. And if your community would shun you or make you an outsider for not adhering to their traditions and values, that's a very hard thing to resist. I mean, there are people who are strong-minded enough and brave enough to make the decision to break away from that and to apostatize from Islam and just say, I am no longer going to subscribe to the traditions and values that Islam requires of me. I'm going to do my own thing. And frequently they're killed for it. And that, of course, the word spreads, obviously. And women know that if they take that decision to rebel against Islam, there could well be dire consequences for themselves, for their families. And it's all tied in with the honor and shame culture that is prevalent within Islamic countries. Mm-hmm. And that's why we don't see more women taking a stand against it. Whatever they might think privately, they might think how nice it would be to walk down the hair with walk down the street with the wind in your hair, was what I was going to say, get rid of that black bin bag that she's been walking around in all her life and wear Western clothes like everybody else does in Western democracy. She's unable to do that, so she rationalizes it in her mind and says to herself, I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to change it into a positive thing. I'm standing with the Islamic community when I do this. And so the problem perpetuates itself down through the generations. And then, of course, you've got the other women, which are Western women who feel, especially feminists, Western feminists, who feel that nobody has the right to impose the patriarchal rules of Judeo-Christian civilization on these poor women. We should let them alone, leave them alone to get on with it. These feminists have absolutely nothing to say when it comes to honor killings, female genital mutilation, all the inequities of Sharia law with the conditions for divorce, which are the ability to divorce is virtually non-existent for women compared to men. The testimony of a woman in court is only worth half that of a man. When it comes to wills and inheritance, a woman can only inherit half as much as a man. The feminists on in Western democracies have virtually nothing to say about this, because they feel that it's far more important to fight against the patriarchal values, as I've said, of Judeo-Christian civilization, and to support the continuance of Islam, implicitly support the continuance of Islam by taking that stance. So there's the two things there, which is the women in Islam themselves and the women who are not within Islam but who are implicitly supporting it.
Mm. And I was listening to what you're saying, and I think I'm more interested in the militant Muslimas, and that you're right. There are Muslimas that wish that they could shed this garb, as it were. You know, the most famous examples, of course, here in Canada in particular, is Aksa Parvis and the Shafia family, sisters and first wife, who were honor killed because they wanted to become Westernized. And my heart bleeds for them. These are the people I work for. These are the Muslims that I work for. I work in the memory of the Shafia family, and I work in the memory of Aksa Parvis, as did Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer. But I am more concerned about the militant Muslims that demand that we have a right to wear our niqabs and our hijabs, and we're going to wear them in the West, whether you like it or not. And it disturbs me greatly when I see them protesting in the streets like they did in Quebec 5 months ago when this family values clause was introduced. And they were there in the streets, and they were showing what. One thing that really bothered me, Tim, is that they had their placards, and one of them was "Keep calm, love your hijab," and they stole that from the UK. I saw that, and it was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe this."
Yeah, of course, the keep calm slogan is applied to pretty much, well, any cause which can be expressed in a couple of words now. Keep calm and have a cup of tea, which is one of the famous things that we used to say over here. It's been hijacked and used for all sorts of nefarious political campaigns, and that's just one of them. Well, okay, it's you know, it's a free country insofar as anybody can pinch one of our slogans, and we don't normally charge for it. But I do see your point that they are aggressively promoting this garb as being a free choice for people, but in fact, if you look into the motives of the women who wear the garments, it's anything but a free choice. They might well say it's a free choice, but in reality, would you wear something like that through choice if you didn't have to worry about peer pressure? I mean, if you're just talking about a health issue, for example, the lack of vitamin D that you're going to get because your body is shielded from the sunshine. That's just one example. The long-term effect of not having enough vitamin D in your body is actually really severe. And all right, that's just a health issue. That's not even talking about the cultural side of it. But if you didn't have the peer pressure to worry about, I submit that if you didn't have the threat of men beating you to a pulp for not following Islamic culture and traditions, if you didn't have the peer pressure from the rest of your community, you wouldn't wear that black bin liner over yourself for 1 minute longer. You just wouldn't do it. You know, it must be really restrictive having to wear something like that all the time. And I would venture to suggest that if it wasn't for those factors, that most women would cast it off without a moment's second thought. Because, as you say, it's not a religious requirement. If it was in the Quran that you must wear this particular garment, well, okay, women might point to that as an external reason for them to do something which they otherwise might find uncomfortable, but it isn't. It is purely a cultural thing, and if you didn't have the cultural pressure, then I'm sure that most women wouldn't want to wear it as a matter of course.
Well, that's exactly, we're all going with this, and we can run circles around this topic, absolutely. And but I think that I think people are getting the gist that we're exposing something different, something new, and I hope that we're giving people something to think about, and that when you see a woman donning the hijab and the niqab in the West, in particular, of course, is that it is a political statement, and I do not understand exactly why they have such a vested interest in protecting such oppressive garb. But they do, Tim. They do. And sorry, I'm trying to type with one hand here, but
okay.
It's frustrating to me, and I don't like this in the West, and I would like to see it banned. I would like to see the niqab and the hijab and everything banned in the West. I don't think there's a place for it. It certainly does not belong on our university and college campuses. It does not belong in our banking institutions, our government institutions, our postal institutions. It does not belong anywhere. I think that it is absolutely insanity that we have to tolerate this. They do not tolerate us. Islam does not tolerate us. Why do we have to tolerate them? This is not right, Tim. It's just not right. I get so mad. I'm spitting nails. I'm listening to Dr. Bill Warner talk about this, and I'm sitting here, and I'm listening, and I'm just getting angrier and angrier, and I do. Mm-hmm. And people know I get angry because they listen to the F-bomb show on Fridays. And by the time that show is done, everybody's drunk because every time I drop the F-bomb, everybody's got to take a shot of whiskey. But when I come across these stories, I do. I still get very, very vexed, and I get very worked up, and it's only because of the fact that I have very, very sophisticated listeners and smart listeners that I rein myself in. But I am not putting up with this. I'm not putting up with it. Tim is not. I don't think our listeners are, Tim. And I think that it is intolerable that they can march around and they can demand their Sharia rights in our Western societies, in our Western courts. They can demand their Sharia courts in the United States and the UK. Canada so far has evaded that. But believe me, it's coming soon to a town near you. And these enclaves that they create, and these communities that they so-called communities, and they congregate, and these mosques that they establish, and this is it. I've had it because you know why? Because I have a legacy I'm protecting that's called my children, and Tim has children too, and we have a legacy to protect. I am not going to sit down and allow this to run roughshod over me, nor is Tim, and nor are you. You have children. You have a legacy to protect. Where were you when the war was being fought? What are we facing now today? We have these Muslimas coming out, and they are using the niqab and the hijab as a political statement, saying that we're here, we're different, and fuck you, suck it up. I've had it.
So not to worry. Just a minute while I have a shot of whiskey, and I'll be right with you. Right, where was I? No, you're absolutely right, and what Bill Warner has said in that video, and it's worth listening to once or twice, ladies and gentlemen. And that's true for a lot of what Bill Warner writes and says. It bears listening to more than once because there are meanings within meanings with what he's saying, and I suppose the bottom line is that He is looking at everything that surrounds Islam from a political context, and that is absolutely the right way to look at it, because Muslims will given the opportunity, present Islam as a benign and tolerant religion of peace, totally compatible with Western civilization and our cherished notions of parliamentary democracy in every respect, and it's a complete lie. And as far as what they say about the hijab and niqab being a personal choice for women, that is, it's not a complete lie, but it's only partially true. Women may make the choice to put that on in the morning, but that's because they know that if they do not, they are going to suffer severe consequences in as with peer pressure, with the opprobrium of their peers and other members of the community. They may suffer physical violence from their husbands if they do not wear what is considered to be suitably modest dress when they go out of the house. So free choice is not really the word that we should be looking for. It is a political thing. And if we were to say, if we were all to recognize that the entire phenomenon and everything of Islam and everything surrounding it is primarily political in nature, and everything that Islam does and everything that Muslims do is designed to promote Islam and to gain an advantage over the kuffar in whatever way is possible, large or small, Muslims see an opportunity because we have been softened up with the twin evils of political correctness and multiculturalism. Muslims see an opportunity to push the long-term goal of Islamic domination on us, and they see us submitting because we're rendered unable to fight back sensibly if we have been infected with the memes, if you like, of political correctness and multiculturalism. And by meme, what I mean is a system of thinking that is so pervasive that you don't know, if you're infected with it, you don't know how to start fighting back. And that's where a lot of people are at the moment. And it's, you know, we shouldn't be looking down on them and saying, oh, there's something wrong with you because you're thinking like this. They are the product of 40 years of liberal education in the West. The notions of political correctness and multiculturalism are almost hardwired into people, and so when they are presented with something like Islam, the natural reaction of somebody who's infected with this meme is to say, oh, it can't be all that bad, let's just accommodate them, and can't we all get along and everything will be fine. And the political correctness and multiculturalism that allows this, that's going to be what effectively destroys our civilization if we don't recognize it and fight back. Okay, liberals render themselves incapable of fighting back if they absorb this political correctness and multiculturalism nonsense, but it doesn't mean the rest of us have to. And as long as we can withstand being called Islamophobe and racist and bigot and hate monger from time to time, we can mount an effective defense. But what we must not do is to take it to heart when people call us racist, bigots, Islamophobes, hate mongers, and so on. We have to say that is part and parcel of mounting an effective defense. We are going to come under attack. But if we recognize the rightness of our cause and say Islam is a political means of exerting control, which if allowed to carry through to its logical conclusion, will destroy a perfectly good Judeo-Christian civilization, then we can mount an effective fight back. But we have to be convinced of the rightness of our cause. And that's what you and I are here for, Kel, to explain to people who know that something is wrong but are not quite sure exactly what it is. I mean, I should think the people who listen to our shows by now have got a pretty good idea of what is wrong and what needs to be done in order to fix it. But there are plenty of other people out there who only have a vague notion that something is wrong and don't know what to do. And if we can explain it in these terms to our listeners, and they in turn can explain it to the circle of people that they come across in the same sort of way, then we will be able to get the message out there and increase the awareness to the point that something will eventually be done, because more people than not will understand the implications of what's going on.
I want to take a bit of a break right now, but I wanted to explore something. And Dodgy Dave brought up a really good point in the chat room, in that he badgers these feminist groups, and he accuses them of the double standard of protectionism of women, and that they're so pro this, but they're not there for the oppressed sisters. And I want to explore that one in a moment, but I think what I need to do is I need to take a break, because my dog is crying upstairs and I don't know what's going on.
Okay.
So let's take a little bit of a break. But I do have something here. My friend sent me this song, and he usually listens as a guest. So, Terry, if you're in the chat room, mwah, thank you for this song. We're going to play this, and we're going to see everybody back in 3 minutes. Oh, wrong song. Oops, that was the wrong one. That's my closing song on Friday. Here it is, guys.
Ooh, okay.
Different than what people are used to hearing on my show, and that would be and there you go, ladies and gentlemen, that was the Fox on the Run by the Country Gentlemen. So there you go. So thank you, Terry, very much for that. And ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Red Fox Blogger. And you are listening to Tim Burton and Cal Fritzy. And we were talking about the political statement behind the hijab and the niqab. Tim?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here.
Dodgy Dave brought up a really good point in the chat room, but before we even get into that, I want to say hi to A12 Iggy Mom. Hey, Mom. I'm glad you're here, Iggy. But, yeah, Dodgy Dave brought up a really good point. Where are the feminists? I call them the feminazis because I'm not a feminist. I think feminism has ruined at least two good generations, in my opinion. And the feminists, though, they're so bent on their abortion rights and the single mother rights, and their you can do it all. You can do this, and you can break through that glass ceiling. And I think that the feminism has actually destroyed family values, and they have destroyed the core of what our Western society should be, and that is take care of each other and love your family and be part of your family and raise your family. And they are not there, though, for the Muslimas. Like, where are they when Soria M, where were they in 1979 when Soria M was stoned to death? Where were they then? Where are they when kids get shot in the head because they want an education in Pakistan? Where are they when Afghanistani women are being beaten about the legs and the back because their ankle is showing? Where are they then? They're not there. And they are the ones who encourage women in the West to wear these hijabs and these niqabs. They're encouraging that, hey, you go, girl. It's your right. You know, that's your statement, babe. Like, but they are so clueless about all of this, I think, in that they will not protect those who are truly oppressed.
Well, they certainly are clueless because they're fighting a battle which is largely spurious. They see the existing order of things, or that is to say the order of things before Islam came into the equation, they see oppression through the patriarchal nature, or so they see it, of Judeo-Christian civilization, and they see Islam as a tool to help them beat that down. And so they're overlooking all the obvious flaws that Islam has, and they are doing that in favor of taking that tool and using it to their own advantages. So the fact that there are these poor women in Islam that suffer tremendously through the inequalities of the Sharia matters very little to them. They overlook that in favor of what they see as a greater goal. And it's highly... Well, I say it's highly immoral. It's not a morality I would subscribe to. I happen to think that the Judeo-Christian civilization that we have enjoyed over the past 2,000 years that has given us what we have today, although it may not be perfect, is possibly the best framework devised by mankind for the advancement of humanity. And if we destroy it, then I think we should be very careful what we wish for, because what will take its place will be 1,000 times worse. And certainly the Islamic civilizational model can't hold a candle to the achievements of the Judeo-Christian civilization. And multiculturalists may say that I'm racist and Islamophobic for saying so, but Yabu sucks is what I say to them. What do you say, Kel?
Well, I've had it with them. They're not helping me. They're not helping my cause to help oppressed women. This is what I do. I help oppressed women. I don't stand up to militant women. I certainly will not stand up to militant Muslimas. And if the feminazis are not on my side, I have no use for them. That's all.
Oh, you just beat me to it, Kel. I was going to say. Well, I'll turn it over to you. Would you like to introduce our caller?
I have no idea who this is. Hey, 2984, welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. What's your name and what's your comment or question?
Well, my name was Lucha last time I checked. Hi, you guys.
Lucha.
Lucha.
Hi, I want to get you guys' take on something. I'm not sure. I don't even have the article up in front of me, but it was, I'm sure you guys saw the article about that woman who dressed up in a hijab for a day, or no, actually for 19 days, to see if, you know, to try to prove that there was racism, But instead, she was treated very nicely. She was treated with a whole lot more respect than when she didn't wear it. So I want to get your guys' take on this. Do you think that it was because, like, the nice, respectful treatment that she got from people, do you think it was because of their respect for Islam, or do you think it was because of maybe their fear of Islam and that they should treat her with respect because they fear it?
Fear. Absolute fear.
Fear?
Yeah.
How about you, Tim?
Absolutely. I think it's fear because we're afraid to step on Islam. I think that we're afraid to confront Islam. Islam is a dangerous entity. People know it, but they're afraid to deal with it. And believe me, Tim in Great Britain, he can expand on that much more eloquently more than I can. So, Tim.
Well, I think in that particular instance, it was quite interesting that what she termed respect was probably the lack of interaction that she encountered from people who otherwise might have talked with her, perhaps flirted with her, perhaps made a pass at her. And she probably didn't get any of that, which is understandable, because when you approach somebody in a niqab, for example, the last thing you're likely to get from a red-blooded Western male, for example, is to have a pass made at you. And, you know, you might not enjoy men making passes at you. You might not particularly enjoy men flirting with you. You might not particularly enjoy men talking to you. And so under those circumstances, if you put on a hijab and you get none of those things happening, you might say, oh, everybody's being a lot more respectful. But of course, what's actually happening is nobody wants to interact with somebody wearing a bin bag. No, you know, you just don't want to. It's intimidating, it's threatening, and you would far rather go away and do something useful with your life. So I think that what she's referring to in the way of respect is actually misplaced. And as Kel says, it's got a lot to do with fear of offending. Because everybody knows that if you offend a Muslim, you're likely to bring far more trouble down on your head than if you were to offend somebody. I nearly said the word normal. I'll just say somebody non-Muslim. If you offend a non-Muslim, all right, you might get a few. You might get a few repercussions from it, but you won't get the repercussions that you will get from offending a Muslim. As I've said before, if you offend enough Muslims, they won't just sit down and write letters to the Guardian. They'll go out and riot and cause all sorts of mayhem and problems that you really don't want. So most people would probably say, I really don't want to interact with that. I will go away and do something more useful with my life. And she is taking that as respect, whereas, in fact, it's nothing of the sort. It's just an unwillingness to interact for obvious reasons based on fear and the intimidation and the threatening atmosphere that it creates when you wear that hijab. So, yeah, Kel said fear. I said probably 100 times more words, but it does come down to that. So yes, Lucia, that is what I think it is.
Good answers, thank you guys.
Oh, Lucia, absolutely. And I was just looking at another case study that you brought up. This one was in the United States.
Was that addressed to Lucia or to Lucia?
Oh, that was addressed to Lucia.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
Okay. What? I didn't.
Oh, that case study, that woman that dressed up as the experiment, was that conducted out of the United States? Because I have another one here where a woman in Saudi Arabia did the exact same thing, and she pretty much got the same treatment. The difference. You're right, Lucia. The deference, it just makes me ill in that we see these women in their niqabs and that they are given a special treatment. They're treated like kid gloves because people, in my opinion, and Tim reiterated my opinion, in that people are simply just afraid to deal with them. And it's frightening, Lucia. It's frightening that this goes on.
It is. And the study that I was talking about was in Canada, Cal.
Oh, yes. Now I know what you're talking. Yes. She was out of Quebec, and she dressed up in the, you're right. She wore the niqab, and, wear a niqab for a week, and she was treated deferentially. You're right. That is
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. She was a university student. I think it might have been, I don't know if it was Concordia University, but she decided to do her own social study, and she walked around, and she noticed a difference in attitude when it came to people dealing with her. Some people looked at her askew, but for the most part, she was treated with a little more, quote-unquote, respect than she expected. But like I say, I think that was born of fear because people don't want to deal with, they don't want to deal with the issue of Islam.
Exactly. All right, thank you guys, and congratulations on your win, Tim.
Oh, thank you very much, Lucia. Yeah, I was quite pleased about it myself, as you probably know. And thank you for all your support. And that goes for everybody in the chat room and who's listening tonight. Thank you for all your support. You've been really wonderful, and I am so humbled and honored to call you all my friends. So thank you. Thank you again.
Same here. Rock on, you guys.
Thank you, Lucia. Thank you very much. And, wow, she is just so fantastic. Yep, this was a Canadian college student, and she conducted the social experiment to see if people would treat her differently if she wore a hijab. She was wearing the hijab. And her name is Anissa Rahani, and she is a third-year student at Queen's University in Ontario. So my apologies. I did cite Concordia University, which is in Quebec, but she was she's an attendee of a Queen's University in Ontario, and she wore that garb. She wore it for 18 days, as Lucia apprised us of, and she said that she wanted to see if people in her community were racist towards minority groups, and that she noticed that people actually treated her more kindly, with more respect, than when she didn't wear the hijab. Tim, that is fascinating.
Well, I rather think it depends on the perception. As I say, I'm sure she noticed there was a difference, but the difference was probably for reasons that she didn't perceive. Not because people would go out of their way to be rude and nasty to her, but they would go out of their way not to react to her in the way they would normally react to people because of the intimidatory factor, which is a huge unspoken thing. Nobody will say that they're intimidated. Nobody will say that they feel threatened. They just won't interact with you. And determine that is somehow equivalent to respect or them being nice to you is actually to misperceive the entire situation. So she might well have come away with the impression that people respected her more and were nicer to her, but what was actually happening was they were choosing not to interact with her, and that's quite different. And I feel sure that although she personally might disagree with me, I feel sure that that was what was going on during those 18 days.
Oh, absolutely. And it was just an interesting study. How people, they change. They change. And the deference, though, bothers me. I think that they should be taken to task. I think that they should be stared down, not be offered, the red carpet treatment as this person was granted. I don't believe in that. I think that, it's interesting. This took place in Canada, like, Lucia said. And Anissa Rahani, a third-year student at Queen's University, engaging in this. And the different treatment that she received, and it was not what I would expect to be seen. But we do have another caller here, Tim, and I'm going to bring him on right now, and I believe this is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. Yes, good evening, Tim and
Hello,
Carol.
Jeff.
And I'm sorry I'm a little bit late. I was a little bit tied up. Well, no, just a bit busy. No, Tim, I know what you're thinking. No, I'm not into that.
You don't know what I'm thinking.
I know what you're thinking, Carol. But it's good to be here. I'm sorry I'm a little bit late this evening, but I said I've had a few things I've had to sort out. But something that's... which I've noticed today that we've talked about on many shows about the indoctrination in the schools with Islam being associated. And it seems, Tim, where you live, there's 25 schools under the spotlight or because of some radicalization that's possibly going on.
I think it's something that we talk about all the time.
Sorry, Tim, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say this is all a result of the Trojan horse letter that was circulating in around the Birmingham area that came to the attention of the authorities and basically outlined a plan by Islamic radicals to take over positions of authority within various schools in the Birmingham area. And by positions of authority, I don't just mean the teachers or head teachers' positions, but also the governing body positions. And Michael Gove, the education minister, has announced an inquiry into quite a few of these schools, which is quite right too, because if there is undue pressure being put on the teachers or the head teachers or the governing body to get certain people there to resign and have them replaced by Islamic hardliners, then that is a thing which has to be stamped on very firmly and immediately. So Michael Gove is quite right in what he's done. The interesting thing I found, and I don't know if you've seen this today, Jeff, but we had the Right Reverend, I forget what his first name is, Right Reverend of Bishop of Birmingham came onto the TV and said, well, of course, we have to tread very carefully because of Islamophobia. Oh, my goodness, please spare me. Spare
well,
me.
Am I surprised with that statement
Right Honourable? But what he said was that Muslims who are well integrated and assimilated into our society will be feeling very resentful that their community is yet again being singled out and targeted in the name of Islamophobia. And he totally fails to see the bigger picture, which is that if you subscribe to an ideology that promotes a totalitarian worldview and resorts to such underhand tactics and lies and deceit and attempts to infiltrate our democratic structures in that way, lead people to treat everybody with the same brush, and the only way really to avoid that is to say to yourself, well, I'm a Muslim, and in fact perhaps there may be something wrong with Islam, and if I look into it I may find things that I don't want to find, but nevertheless it's better to know the truth than to ignore it. And
it doesn't matter what Islam does, it's always going to be in the right, whether it's wrong, you know, well, and that's in most Muslims' eyes, though, Tim, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that is the case. But Muslims are choosing to project this onto the rest of us, and they're saying, well, we think that Islam is absolutely fine and dandy, and therefore you, as non-Muslims, should think exactly the same way. And if you don't, we're going to make a fuss about it. And we should have the moral fibre to stand up and say, well, you might think that Islam is perfect, but we do not. We think Islam is flawed, it has some highly undesirable characteristics, and it is totally unsuitable as a civilizational structure to be allowed allowed anywhere in the public space in our Judeo-Christian civilization. And if we had more politicians and people in positions of authority who would stand up and say that, then Islam would lose a lot of its power. But at the moment, we're allowing it to do these things.
I was going it's not just Birmingham, though. I've noticed the story said that it's relating to other towns and cities like Bradford and other ones. So it's just not like in Birmingham that has come under the spotlight. But it does seem that just lately, as we know, the Muslim Brotherhood decided to move their offices because Cameron said that he wants to look into the Muslim Brotherhood's workings, this, that, and the other. And all of a sudden, they've up their packed their bags, rolled their rugs up, put them under the arm, and they've buggered off to Austria. I mean, and it's true, isn't it, Tim? And it does seem that they realise that we've got them on. I think we've got them on the run. I think if it wasn't for what we've done, as yourself, Tim, and Kel, and myself with the English Defence League, doing what we've done, maybe, you know, these things would still carry on, because we really are putting Islam under the spotlight, all of us, and what a fantastic job we're doing. If it makes politicians speak out, that's all we want to do. We want them to get their act together, because they're paid the big bucks. We're not.
Well, it's certainly true. And I mean, it's something we discuss frequently. But one thing I would like to ask you, Jeff, is that we've been talking tonight about the political ramifications of the hijab and the niqab. And I was wondering if you had a view specifically about those items. We heard from Bill Warner a little while ago. We had a 7-minute clip where he specifically referred to it in political terms. It seemed to me that was actually a good way to approach it, rather than saying to individual Muslims that, you know, you've got a right to wear something as an individual. The political nature of the hijab and the niqab would suggest that would be the thing to focus on. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think this is the point that we've often talked about on other shows. This and we've often talked about this, and I would go along with what Bill Warner said, that what they're doing is they're making a statement. They don't need to wear this garb, do they? In the Quran, it doesn't say that they should be covered from head to toe or anything like that. It doesn't mention about it. Maybe, you know, cover something of your face, whatever, but it doesn't say to cover yourself totally in the Quran. I think anywhere you look, it won't say that. But it does seem that some of these women, I don't know why they do it. Do they like to feel, to be subdued? Maybe, I don't know, because of the mindset, it seems that they've been, you know, the generation after generation, they use it. Maybe it's just a part of what they do that they'd rather feel the victim. As we know, Islam, it always classes itself as the victim because the rest of the world picks on it. And this is, you know, even with the atrocities it does, it's still the victim. So I think it's a statement. I was looking at it as a political statement as well, in that sense that they're making, Tim. Go as far as long as that. And as I say, there's no need for it. I mean, I can't understand. And the reason why they wear these, you know, the veil, this now, it's just so that they won't be raped. If it comes down to it, you know, we've got to say what it is. In these countries, Islamic countries, you know, if they're not covered up, they can be raped. This is what it is. But they haven't got that aspect when they come to Western countries. They don't have the fear of that because we've got laws to protect the women. That's the whole thing about it. And they don't have to worry about there has to be so many witnesses to what happened. We don't have that here. If there's a rape and it has to be investigated and there's signs that it was a rape, then it should be prosecuted to the highest extent of what the law can offer. I can't understand why they carry on walking around. You know, I see one walking through town a while ago and I basically had a confrontation with her. You know, she had westernised gear on, but she was wearing a veil. Could you understand this? I mean, the mindset, why? Why cover your face up? You got something to hide? Are you really that ugly?
Well, Yeah, I was saying to Kel and to the listeners a little earlier that there's a number of reasons behind it. Yet it probably isn't just one particular reason, but a number of reasons. One is the peer pressure of what will people in her community say if she goes out unveiled. It could have severe consequences for her as an individual. It could have severe consequences for her family. So you've got the peer pressure there. You've also got, of course, the fact that if her husband disapproves, she could be subjected to violence, and that violence could go as far as her being killed for reasons of so-called honour. So that's the second reason. But a third reason is, of course, that if she decides that, all right, she might not actually like wearing it, but it is a statement that she is part of the Islamic community and therefore not part of the Kufar community. It's us against them, and it's that. The implied threat and the actual intimidation that somebody wearing something like that provokes that is the root cause of the problem, and they do it because they of either fear of what happens if they don't, or as a statement to say we're here and we're better than you are.
It's quite the supremacist. I mean, as we know, that they do think they're supreme over anybody else, don't they? They look down their noses at the infidel, the kufar.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Kel. I'm running along with this. I just wanted to... Actually, the reason why I called in was because it was jumping out at me all day, and I thought I needed to come, because it is a part of your community, the Birmingham schools, Tim, so I hope you didn't mind me interrupting a fantastic show this evening, and I will catch the rest of it in the archives later on this evening or tomorrow.
Oh, Jeff, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And thank you. Thank you very, very much.
It's my pleasure, Kel. As I say, it's just something that, you know, because it's so close to, you know, well, Tim lives in Birmingham, and the story related to what's going on in his city, and what's going on in other parts of the country, that they are starting to ratchet up. They're starting to, maybe all the talk that we've said over the time, Kel, and that with this letter that was out there, this anonymous type of a letter that was written outlining what their plans to do in the schools, that it's come to light, and maybe we're going to see some common sense starting to prevail a bit. I just hope so, Tim. I really, really do, because we've worked so hard over the years to highlight all these issues within our schools, the halal industries, all these things are so important. It's about time they recognised it and started to look into it, like all we've been asking them to do for way back way. The last 5 years we've been saying this, haven't we? The last five years.
Well, we have, and this is what I was saying the other day on one of the other shows, is that organisations such as the English Defence League in this country, when they first started up, they were vilified by our political elites and mainstream media, and saying... the political elites would say that the EDL and groups like it were just a bunch of hooligans, but in fact they have been proved right in what they have said in so many areas, and that this is another example.
Well, I mean, the thing about it is, Tim, that we've done is we've highlighted all the issues that was really bad in this country, and you know, we're a symptom of the political, the political arena of not doing the right things for the people in this country. And we're just a symptom that it's bound to happen, where people will say enough's enough, and it's what we see back in 2009.
Yeah, and Jeff, you know what? We are down to our last 4 minutes of talking.
Oh, my goodness,
before
me,
we play ourselves out. And so I'd hate to be kind of rude.
No, Kel. Thank you for taking the call tonight as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, see you soon, Jeff. See you soon.
God bless you guys. Doing great work.
Jeff, thank you so very, very much. And
you're very welcome.
Yeah, we are down to our last talking points, but we want to remind you that Tim and myself, that we are also the co-host on Radio Jihad Network. and that Vito Esposito and Al Corman are so gracious in their time and allowing the time slot to be there. Tomorrow night, our guest will be Dr. Terry Jones, and we know him as Pastor Jones out of Florida. He is the person that wanted to encourage the Let's Burn a Koran Day, and he was vilified for that. And he has come out with a new book as to why Islam is the devil. He will be expanding on that book tomorrow night on Radio Jihad Network. And to remind you that tonight, Vito Esposito has his show tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So please try to be there for that. But I hope that Tim and myself have given you more homework to do, because believe me, it is absolute mass Islamity. We do have to stop the insanity. And with that, I'm going to give Tim the final talking points.
Yes, I think the one big thing that comes out of all this is that we need to start thinking about Islam in political terms, and that's if we aren't already thinking about it in that way, as I'm sure a lot of listeners already will be. And when I say thinking about it in political terms, it means advancing an argument against those people who would say that it's the right of an individual Muslim woman to wear what she wants, which is only partially the truth. And the reason that people get away with these arguments is because we're conditioned through political correctness and multiculturalism to be less assertive about what we see as right and wrong than our previous generations would have been. In previous generations, people would have said, what you're proposing is completely wrong from a moral and ethical point of view. And we tend not to say that these days. We tend to take the view that, all right, we've got a certain way of looking at things, and if other people think differently, well, that's okay, we'll just live and let live. But there comes a point where we can't do that anymore, because there are so many people who are trying to tear down our civilization. If we don't make a stand for what is right right now, we are in danger of losing our civilization. And for those of you who think that, well, maybe that's not such a bad thing, I would say to you, be careful what you wish for, because what will come along to replace it will be 1,000 times worse than what we have now. So give it some thought, ladies and gentlemen. Take away what we've been talking about tonight. Think about it. Talk about it with your friends. Come back and tell us next week what you think, because it's an important issue. I would argue there's no more important issue in the 21st century that we're likely to experience, and we have to resolve it. And we have to resolve it in favour of the morals and ethics and traditions and values of our Judeo-Christian civilization. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you ever so much for staying with us during the course of this show. And a big thank you to Kel, who works so hard in putting this show together and all the other shows that she does. She's an absolute gem and worth her weight in gold. So I say to you, good night, Kel, and good night to our listeners, and hope that we see you again very, very soon.
Absolutely. And Tim, thank you very much once again for being the best co-host the gal could ask for, and I mean that sincerely.
Mm-hmm.
This has been another banner show. I hope that we brought you a little more information about what is going on within the realm of Islam. Ladies and gentlemen, please have a wonderful evening, and don't forget to join Vito Esposito at Radio Jihad Network in an hour. I'll be there. I hope to see you there as well. Ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful evening. Have a wonderful week. We will see you tomorrow night at the Radio Jihad Network. And, of course, you will always see us here Mondays, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Have a great week. And remember, like I say, mass Islamity, stop the insanity. Bye. Bye, Tim.
Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye, Kel. See you soon.
Keep hope alive.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb.
Keep hope.
Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had.
Yeah.
Give you the will to carry on another day. Another day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye. Cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy. Want your foolish pride, want your beautiful